en colloque. Une émission de la rédaction de Canal Academy. On retrouve Élodie Courtejoie.
Bonjour. Ouragan, pluie torrentielle, crues, sécheresse. Depuis une cinquantaine d'années, la planète connaît des épisodes climatiques extrêmes à répéter. En janvier et avril 2007, par exemple, les températures de surface sur Terre ont été respectivement plus chaudes de 1,89 degré et de 1,37 degré par rapport aux moyennes enregistrées depuis 1880. Aucun continent n'a été épargné par les cataclysmes. Alors, face à tous ces bouleversements climatiques, quelles sont les connaissances manquantes aux écologues, climatologues, physiciens pour prévenir les événements extrêmes? De quelles informations disposent-ils à ce jour? Élément de réponse dans cette quatrième partie d'une série de cinq enregistrée lors du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007. Cette quatrième partie s'inscrit dans le thème central du colloque qui consiste à identifier quelles connaissances acquises ou à acquérir sont nécessaires pour préparer les sociétés humaines aux événements climatiques extrêmes. Chercheurs français et étrangers se sont penchés pendant 3 jours sur ce thème. Dans quelques instants, vous allez pouvoir entendre les interventions en anglais de Philippe Naveau, Bernard Derrida, Hervé Le Treut et Geoffroy Bolton. Tour à tour, en fonction de leur spécialité, ils nous dressent le bilan de leurs connaissances actuelles sur les événements climatiques extrêmes. Tout de suite, nous débutons par la communication de Philippe Naveau du Laboratoire des sciences du climat et de l'environnement. Il détaille pour nous les méthodes statistiques pour l'analyse des extrêmes climatiques. Au cours de la deuxième demi-heure, c'est Bernard Derrida, membre de l'Académie des sciences, qui prend le relais, professeur au Laboratoire de physique statistique et à l'École normale supérieure. Il nous présente quelques modèles simples d'événements extrêmes. Ses communications sont en anglais.
So, what will be the structure of this talk? First, I'm going to try to define one more time. I think everyone did that before, but what I think what could be a good definition of extremes, and that's I think a difficult topic already. And then after that, I will try to apply this definition to three different problems. The first problem will be how to measure the dependence among extremes, especially among maxima. Okay. The second topic is going to do, can you do interpolation of extremes? Okay. And the last topic will be how to deal with downscaling. That means how to go from the large scale to the small scale. So what I mean by that, if you look at this example of Vaison-la-Romaine, where you can see there's a big flood caused to a precipitation event, a very strong one, and you can see it's very local in time, and in space. And that's, I think, the difficulty of dealing with extreme. If you compare that, for example, to very large scale, if you want to do downscaling, you have to downscale from somewhere. You can look, for example, at this figure from Karin's wires in 2007, and this figure show a lot of curves in colors, but mostly these colors correspond to the return level, 20-year return level, of different climate models. And what you can see from this graph, at the x-axis you can see the latitude, and in the middle you have the equator and the tropics, and you can see that each color that represents a model, for example the blue one I think in the IPSN model, are very different. You know, you can go from 20 to 200 millimeters, and if you look at the black curve corresponds to the reanalysis data, which is kind of a proxy for real observation, but it's old. And you can see that on the time period 91-2000, so real time period in some sense, not in the future, you can see there's a big discrepancy. And that shows the difficulty of capturing, I think, extreme events like precipitation, even from climate model. And I think Serge Planton tomorrow is going to speak a little bit more about this kind of a climate model, and I think Hervé Le Treut too this afternoon. So I'm not going to spend too much time on climate. What I'm going to spend time is to say, well, from the real observation, recording at the weather station, what we can say, and you know, we'll see from there. Now I'm going back to my first question, which was, what is the definition of extremes? Okay, and I think a good definition from that maybe come from Emil Gembol, who was a German statistician, a, a pacifist and an activist, who say it is impossible que l'improbable n'arrive jamais. And I think here it's a key, there is a key word here, improbable. I think that's what I mean by extreme. I mean something who could happen, but is going to happen very rarely. Okay? So what does that mean? That means the concept, I think, for extreme, for me at least, is to say that it's going to be closely related to the concept of probability. It's a concept of occurrence. Okay? And so then, after that, we can say that it's a rare event, and also, in most cases, it has to be a very high amplitude. So let's see how can we be more precise about that. And to be more precise, I would like to define two types of variables. You can look, like in climatology, people like to speak about maxima of temperature or precipitation. Or in hydrology, people like to speak about return level. Okay, and what is a return level? It's only a quantile. So you have to, it's linked to the fact you want to know how, what is the probability to be higher than a given threshold. That's the basics of, is it working anymore? Yeah. So let's go back to a long time ago, in 1928, there were Fisher and Tippett who developed a very nice theory in the simple case, which means that if you take sample maxima and you sample from that and the sample size increase, it's very something very important happen. It's like the distribution of this maxima is not going to be anything, it's going to be a generalized extreme value distribution. Okay, so it's a little bit like if you take a sum, if you take the sum of variables, it should be a normal variable, a Gaussian variable. Okay, so here, that's a key result, and that means we can apply, and in fact can interpolate, if necessary, in the tail of the distribution. That was for maxima. So later on, there is a generalized Pareto distribution, and it was quoted from Pareto, in some sense, who was an economist. And it's here it's a different question, is to say, well, suppose, for example, I know it's been raining here like more than, let's say, 20 millimeters of water. What is the chance to be even higher than that? And so when the threshold is very high, probability tells us something. Let's say the probability tells us that the distribution which is the best fit for these exceedances is going to be the generalized Pareto distribution. So you have the formula here, and you have two parameters, xi and sigma. But you can say, well, I don't understand exactly what that means. So what I did for the shape parameter, xi, I simulate three time series. And for the upper panel, which is this one here, so for the upper panel, you can see that xi was minus 0.5. And what you can see here is like the distribution is, the variable is not going to be very strong. Okay, in fact, it's bounded. If you take xi equals to zero, you have something a little bit different. That means you can have from time to time strong value, but not very strong. And now if you take the last one, the bottom panel, what you can see is the fact that you have very high values from time to time. And so if you think about precipitation, you're almost like you'd say like for xi, a negative, a positive xi that will correspond to the precipitation data. So now I'm going to, that was my introduction. And the main point now I want to say that was the research done in the past, many years ago, many decades ago. People, statisticians have been working on probability still for many years. And now there is a multivariate field of extreme value theory. Okay. And the question I would like to address in this talk is to say, how can we use multivariate extreme value theory to answer three different problems? How to measure the spatial dependence among extremes? Okay. The second question is how to interpolate return levels, high return levels in space. And the last problem was downscaling. So I'm going to spend the rest of my time to describe each of these problems. So for the first problem, I started with a simple illustration. It's data from Belgium. You have approximately 90 stations, and from 1951 to 2005, we divided in two parts, winter and summer. And so the question is here, it's fairly simple. If you have a very strong precipitation here, in some city in Belgium, let's say, and then you move by 200 meters, you can say that it's very likely that we have a strong precipitation there too. If you move by 50 kilometers, it's going to be smaller, the dependence. So the question is how to measure this dependence, okay, in a statistical term. So here, don't worry, it's the only equation I put, in fact, in my talk, and I know it's a talk on extremes, and it's extreme to put an equation after lunch, but I did it. So here, I want to know what's happening in space, so I need to take two variables. Okay, so I take the maximum at the location x, okay, and I look at the maximum at the location x plus h, so I move by distance h. And I'm asking the question, so now I have two locations, what is the probability that the two maxima are smaller than u? Okay, so if you use extreme value theory in the bivariate case, you can divide this equation into two different parts. And let's try to illustrate that with a simple case. If the two variables are very far away, the two maxima are very far away, they are independent. Okay, and when you have independent, that means the probability to have the max greater than, less than u and the max of x plus h less than u is going to be the product. So theta of h is going to be equal to 2. Okay, when h is very small, the locations are very small, close to each other, and so then in this case, theta of h equals to 1. So in some sense, theta of h is kind of a similar quantity to the correlation coefficient for Gaussian field. Okay, so if theta is close to 1, that means we are close to the dependence. If theta of h equals to 2, it's close to independence. Okay, so that's a tool to address the issue how to assess the dependence. Okay, so if I continue in that, now I have a quantity theta of h, okay, and I want to estimate it. That's a statistical question. It's very easy to define a quantity. It's much more difficult to estimate it. So to estimate theta of h, we use a concept from geostatistics, which calls a variogram, and a special case of a variogram is called a madogram. And the madogram gives us some information about the dependence. So if the madogram is small, then that means we have a give us the value of theta of h for h large, for h small. So here, the main point I want to make is to say, I define a quantity for the dependence. Now I define an estimator, the madogram, and the madogram is easy to estimate, so I can get theta of h. So now let's like to apply that to my data. So here, to measure the dependence between maxima, I took different block size of maxima. Because you can take, here we have hourly precipitation, so you can take block size of, let's say, monthly maxima of precipitation, or you can take weekly maxima of precipitation. And that's going to be an influence also on the dependence. So on the left side, you have the summer, and on the right side, you have the winter. So what you can see from this graph is the dependence was on the x-axis, the distance between the two points. You need, in Belgium, at least, let's say, around 90 kilometers of difference in summer to get closer to independence. The red the horizontal line corresponds to the dependence. Independence, so. And in winter, the dependence is much stronger. And you can explain that by simple, I think, geophysical reasoning here. So as my first example. My second example, it's going to deal with the Colorado, okay? Colorado, it's a very specific region because, as you can see on this graph, there is the green part corresponds to the plains, okay? So if you take an airplane and you go to Denver from Paris, you arrive and you can see these plains, and then after that, there is the Rocky Mountains, okay? So you have a big slope here. And all my stations here, my 50 stations, were at this intersection, which is a very difficult region, between the plains and the mountains. Okay? And so what we try to do is to say, can you compute the return level of precipitation from this data? Okay? And So what we wanted to do is to take into account of different processes. And here what we took advantage of Bayesian hierarchical modeling. So it's a kind of a... this model, in fact, can be simply explained, I hope, by saying that usually when you have observation, that depends on a process, and then the process depends on parameters. Okay, that's fairly classical in geophysics. And so what you like to get at the end of the day is to say, I would like to have the probability, the distribution of the process and estimate the parameter given the data. Okay, so what you need to do is to inverse this formula. And so you use the Bayes theorem. And now if you look at doing that, you have these three quantities. So on the first line here, you can see that I have the probability of observing the data given the process and the parameters. Okay. Now comes in extreme value theory. Okay, from extreme value theory, I know if I want to look at return levels, high return levels, I'm going to look at large exceedances about a threshold, which means I can use the generalized Pareto distribution. Okay, so I'm going to combine Bayesian statistics and extreme value theory together to compute this probability here, the first one. And the second probability, this probability is a process given the parameters. I'm going to describe my process there. Okay, so maybe it's better to look at this graph to explain what's happening here. So my objective is to compute Z of X, okay, the return level at location X. Okay, this depends on my GPD parameter sigma and xi. Okay, and on sigma and xi, I can put, if I want, some structure. For example, in sigma, I can take care of the elevation, or I can take over the distance between two points. For example, if two stations are very close to each other, they are strongly dependent, so I cannot consider them like independent. So using this kind of technique, you can get a distribution of return levels for each location. In some sense, it's a little bit different than classical statistics, because usually in statistics, you get an estimation of a parameter. Here, I get a distribution. Okay, that means that here, this graph here, it's a return level for 20 years, 20 years return level, and I take the mean of the return levels. And you can see we capture very well the difference between the plains and the mountains. Also, we capture the fact that in some location have more stations, so have a better confidence interval. In other station where we have not too many observations, it's going to be not that good. So, and now I'm going to go to my last topic. I said I was going to have three topics, and the last one, it's called downscaling. So what is that? Well, downscaling, it's simply, you can think you have large-scale variables, let's say from climate models, from reanalysis, or what you like, and then you would like to go at a very fine scale in space and time, okay? And what at the end we want to get extreme precipitation. Usually it's very difficult to go from the large scale to the extreme directly. And one approach, that's not the only one, is to define weather regimes as an intermediate step, okay? And after that, you could decide to do statistical downscaling or dynamical downscaling. It's up to you, both of them have advantages and drawbacks. So because I'm a statistician, I'm going to do statistical downscaling. But I think in the future, what would be good is to do both together, okay? Mix a dynamical and statistical downscaling. And some people started to do that, and I think it's the right direction. So here I'm going to take an example near Chicago, in the region of Illinois. And so we have three types of scale. We have the small scale, which my observations, okay, 37 stations. We have the larger scale, which is my NSEP data, okay? And then we define weather regimes. In fact, here we define four precipitation regimes. And so the question, okay, in terms of uncertainty, that we want to answer is to say, what is the probability to observe precipitation given we know what is the large scale and the state of the regime? That's what we basically want to answer. And as I said before, if we want to deal with extreme, at some point, we have to plug in extreme value theory. So we did that, okay? And we took also into account of the dependence between the different states by using hidden Markov models. So at the end, what we can get, just an example, we get a lot of outputs from this model, but because I have only limited time, I'm just going to give you what kind of improvement you can get from that. So here, it's called a QQ plot, a quantile-quantile plot. And if you do the classical approach, which means without taking into account of extreme value theory, you can say on the left graph, there is the largest point are far away from the line, okay? The straight line in here. Let me show you. So you have a black straight line here, and you can see the extreme events in this case are overestimated. Okay, but if you take an extreme theory into account, then you get a much better fit. Okay, so again, that's the main point of my talk, is to say that, well, probabilists and statisticians have been working for the last, I would say, 50 years on developing very nice tools for modeling extreme events. And I think the climate community in particular, but I think in geoscience and the geophysical community more generally, should take advantage of that and say, well, if we want to understand extreme, and especially if we think extremes, it's basically a concept, a probabilistic concept, because it's a rare event, we should take advantage of this theory. And so I'm going to conclude by this sentence from Pierre-Simon Laplace, because I work at Institut Pierre-Simon Laplace. And I think what's important here is to say that sometime, at some scale, in time or space, we cannot do the explicit computation. And so we'll have some randomness to take into account. Okay. And then in this case, probability could help a little bit. And I think I'm going to stop here.
Now, I am introducing the next speaker, who is Bernard Derrida. Alors Bernard Derrida est professeur à l'Université de Paris 6 et à l'École normale supérieure, où il dirige le laboratoire de physique statistique. Il est membre de l'Académie des sciences de France. Et sa recherche concerne principalement les systèmes dynamiques. Et ce sont des systèmes, la manière dont il les étudie, relie son travail de près à ce qui nous intéresse le plus peut-être aujourd'hui, c'est-à-dire la biologie. Il étudie par exemple les phénomènes d'évolution et de spécialisation. Bernard Derrida is a professor at the University of Paris 6 and at the École Normale Supérieure. He is a member of the French Academy of Sciences. His research deals with the study of dynamic systems with questions having a close relationship with biology, such as evolution and specialization. His theoretical models offer biologists opportunities for application, especially to population changes. And you have the floor. Je vous donne la parole.
Thank you. So today I am going to talk about some very simple models that physicists have introduced and studied in great theoretical detail and these models generate extreme events. Now, I have followed this subject, although I have not worked, most of my work is not related to that. So what I'm going to present is mostly based on things I have read, but I think it is of enough interest to be presented here. So it's why I decided to make the effort of looking at the literature and trying to explain what it was. Now, here it's a long list of references on which my talk is based, so they will be maybe on the web or something, and then if you want to know more about what physicists do on this subject, then you can go there, and lots of things I'm going to say are based on what I have read there. Now, the first thing I want to say is what are the kind of extreme events that people want to look at. And first, I want to say the kind of extreme events which are of no importance at all, and this is borrowed from the paper of Mark Newman, and the kind of extreme events that you might not be interested in at all in this audience is, for example, the height of people, of males, for example. Now, the distribution of the height of people is between 52 centimeters and 272 centimeters, according to the records. And of course, you might have some extreme events that maybe somebody will go to 273, but you don't think that this has much importance and this should be discussed much here. So some events have a narrow distribution, and whatever you do, the maximal event and the smallest event, they have a factor 4, 5 between them, and then if there is a new extreme event, no big change will occur. So on the left here, you have the distribution of the height of humans. On the right, it's the same paper by Mark Newman, it's the speeds on British motorways. The same is true, that more or less they drive at the same speed, and then there is a factor 4 or 3, and then that's it, and there is not much to say about it. Now, the other case, which in fact is of interest here, is the case of earthquakes. And the main difference in earthquakes is that when you look at the energy which is produced in each earthquake, you get something like the curve that you get on the left here, so that you have events, but huge events, and of course, the energy which is produced in an earthquake compared to another one, the ratio might not be 5, but might be 100, 1,000, 10,000, and so on. And so when you look at the time, the energy radiated in earthquakes as a function of time, you see huge, huge events. And people have tried to classify these events according to their strength or the energy which is radiated in each of these events. And one striking effect that you can see in earthquakes, and that we'll see again and again, is that if you just try to look how many earthquakes you have as a function of the energy radiated by an earthquake, you see that the larger the energy, the less events you have, but the way the number of events decays with the energy, it does not decay as fast as in the previous case where, with the heights of people, but it decays rather slowly, and you have a power law decay. And according to the paper I have read, the power law decay is with the power law here, which is about minus 2/3. So somehow you have a power law distribution of events and which decays rather slowly, and it is why you have such big events. So the frequency depends on the energy like a power law. That's probably the only mathematics which will come here are these power laws. So earthquakes have power law distributions, and they are characterized by a number alpha, which is written here 0.66 according to some data which come from a year. I think this is the data which was produced from the, which came out of the data of all the earthquakes during year 95 in California. Now, another case where also you have this power law distributions, and I am going after that to make a quick list of many other situations, is, for example, if you look at the sizes of cities, and then you count how many cities have a given size. And again, there are huge factors between big cities and small cities. It's not like the human height. You can get factors 1,000 or 10,000. So you have, again, a power law. The number of cities as a function of their size, this decreases with a power law, again, with some exponent alpha. And if you look at lots of other situations, you get again and again power laws. And here I have made a list of cases where you get power loss distribution, and all that is borrowed from the paper of Mark Newman that I mentioned before. So we have discussed earthquakes, population of cities. Now, people have looked, for example, in a book like Moby Dick, and looked at what is the frequency of words in a book, and there are words which are extremely frequent, and so you can call them extreme events, and words less frequent, and then you get, again, power laws. Okay, you have diameter of moon craters, copies of book salt, intensity of the wars. In fact, it seems that the most intense war was at the beginning of the 20th century in South America, because this is a way to measure the intensity of the war. It's just to count how many people were killed divided by the population of the population of the countries which are in the war. Again, I think you won't be surprised that there are huge factors in the wealth of people. It's not a factor four, but factor thousands and more. Even the number of phone calls received in a single day. So in America, one customer received more than 300,000 calls the same day. Okay, so there is, again, huge factors. So lots of examples with huge factors. And now, what can you say about quantities or events which have power law distribution? Now, in fact, there are rather simple mathematics about it, which can be done. And one thing here, I have just shown you how important it is, just with this graph, that if the proportion, for example, of richest people decrease, of people decrease like their wealth to the power minus alpha, depending on the value of alpha, you have these different curves. And for example, what you see on this curve is that if alpha is 2.1, that's the upper curve, then maybe 20% of the population vary a very large fraction of the total effect. And so when you vary alpha between 2.1 and, for example, 3.5, you see that the 20% of the richest people will move from 30% to 90%. This is this parameter alpha. There is something even more spectacular which occurs and which happens, for example, in the case of earthquakes. I told you the value of alpha in the case of earthquakes. If alpha is even less than 2, then what happens is that if you add up the contribution for all events, the sum is almost the same as the contribution of the very few largest events. So if you add up, for example, the energy radiated by all earthquakes, it could be that just the 10 or the 50 most strongest earthquakes dominate the energy of all the others. So you see, this parameter alpha has some importance, and especially when alpha is between 1 and 2. And another reason why physicists are very interested in these power laws and in these exponents is that usually these power laws are universal. That is, when physicists build models of all kinds to describe such phenomena, what happens is that at the end of their calculations, they realize that the power laws that you get do not depend on the details of the model. So sometimes they build very, very simplified models. They make a theory for this exponent alpha, exponents like this exponent alpha, and it turns out that many other models and even things that you can observe in nature, then they have exactly the same behavior. Maybe one thing I should say is about these power law distributions before I come to more specific models that people have looked at. I think, of course, this is a statistical approach, so in principle, you cannot predict when will come the next earthquake. But there is, if you know this exponent, there is something definite that you can predict, is that if you observe the largest event during a one-year period, and you ask, what is going to be the size of the largest event which will occur in the next 10-year period, then you can tell roughly what will be its strength. And just to give you an idea,
For example, if you just take 1 year period and you ask what will be, so imagine that you have looked at the system during 1 year period, you have seen some extreme event, and now you ask what's going to happen during a period of 2 years. Then if this number alpha here is 1.5, it's likely that the extreme event that you will see in the period of 2 years will be 4 times larger than what you saw during a period of 1 year. So the extreme event will become very, very strong. On the other hand, if this exponent alpha here, it's about 10, then if you observe a large event during a period of 1 year, during a period of 2 years, then it will be just 1.05 times the strength of what you have seen in the previous period. So you see, depending on this alpha, you will see, you can predict what will be the strength of the extreme events as a function of time, although you cannot tell when they will occur. Now, let me come to two simple models which have been studied by theoretical physics, and this is just two examples because there are many others, but just to give you an idea. And there is one person, who's Perbach, who introduced, or was one of the main authors of the papers where these models were introduced, and theoretical physicists have looked at these models in great details, and now they have a very good knowledge of all kinds of correlations you find in these models. Now, the idea of Perbach, so who died 5 years ago, was to make a simple model of avalanches, for example, as you would find in snow avalanches, and what they considered is a sand pile model. So this is a cartoon of a sand pile model. So imagine that you have a sand pile and then you drop a few grains of sand on it slowly. And then from time to time, you are going to see that the sand drops and then you will see some avalanches. Now here I talk about sand. You could talk about snow or all kinds of events. And in fact, the idea behind it is very similar to what people do when they look at model of earthquakes. You see, when you have earthquakes that are due to the fact that tectonic plates are moving slowly, one in front of the other, and from time to time, somehow the constraints build up slowly, and from time to time, there is an event which occurs that the two things slide, and then again the constraint build up slowly, and so on, and sometimes there is an avalanche. So the idea between this in this sand pile model is just you drop grains of sand slowly, and then you see what happens. And sometimes you drop one grain of sand, and more or less it stops there, and nothing happens, and then another one, until sometimes there is something unstable which occurs, a big avalanche. And then you start again and again. So I am going to explain slightly more details the definition of the model, but let me just say what you see. And what you see is the curve that you have on the right, below on the right, is that what you see as a function of time is that you have events of all kinds of sizes. You have small avalanches, big avalanches, and something which looks very much like the picture I had shown before for earthquakes. Now, let me just say what the model is, and it is just explained briefly on the bottom of the left part. And the model is extremely simple. Now, as a theoretical physicist, you are not going to take grains of sand which have a complicated shape, so they take just cubes, and then they just drop cubes on a lattice, small cubes, like the red one you see here. And they have a rule that whenever you have more than four grains on the same side, then the thing becomes unstable. And so the four grains, they just move to neighboring sides. So here you see the red cube comes. You have four grains on the same side. And so what happens is that these four grains, they just go in the four possible directions. And so this is the way the problem works. So the model works. So most of the time, you drop a grain of sand, and it just stops there. Sometimes it makes a small instability, but sometimes there is a kind of domino effect that you drop a grain of sand, then there is a small instability, but it makes unstable the neighboring sites and so on, and you have a big avalanche which is produced that way. So just to show it in an example here that I have drawn myself, so this is more or less the same kind, the same only picture I have drawn myself here. Imagine that you have this lattice, and then the color on the left, it is just how many grains of sand you have on each side. So some sites have no sand at all, some sites, the blue ones, they have just one grain of sand, the green ones two, the red ones three, and black would be four, but what happens is that as soon as you have four, it becomes unstable. So on the left, you have a certain configuration, the system is in some state, and then you drop one grain of sand, and now it is on one of these squares, and this square, there is just one chance here, one square which was red became black. But it became black, this black becomes unstable, and I am going to show you what happens then. What happens is that this black becomes unstable, so the four grains on that side are going this site becomes unstable, then the four grains are distributed on the four neighbors of this site, but one neighbor itself becomes unstable, so again this instability occurs, and then again and again and again, and so you see that with this very, very simple example, you have dropped one grain of sand, and at the very end, you have an avalanche, and all the sites with a cross are just sites which have been changed because of just this instability, and you have 12 sites which have been changed. Now, this is just an example where you have an avalanche of size 12. But if you take a system much larger, it might happen that sometimes you have a huge avalanche, and in fact, when I had shown this picture here, this is exactly the kind of data that you get. So for this very specific sand pile model, you get extreme events, you get huge events with huge avalanches out of nowhere. You don't need any external reason to produce this extreme event. So this is one model which was introduced by Perbach and co-workers. And then what they tried to look at is to build models for the evolution of biodiversity and to explain mass extinction. So here I have found on the web a picture which shows that the extinction as a function of history. So if you go back into the past, you have all these huge events, and I guess, but I am sure the audience are much better experts than me, but for example, the dinosaurs, they just correspond to one of these peaks where the disappearance of dinosaurs. And the first thing that you can see here is that the picture is very similar to what I have shown you in the case of earthquakes or in the case of the sand pile model. Again, you have as a function of time events, and then the size of the events are very different. You get huge factors, exactly like what we have when we have power law distribution. So, of course, in front of the audience, you know that you can have many reasons for all these events, external causes like plate tectonics, the effect of meteorites, volcanisms, change of climate, change of salinity of sea, all kinds of reasons can produce such big events in mass extinction, but also you can have the point of view, which is the point of view in all these very simplified models, that even if you had not all these external causes, still you would have these big extreme events in mass extinction. And the reason is just you don't need any physical reason, it is just part of the evolution that from time to time there is one species which disappears just for no particular strong reason, but then because of coevolution all the species are connected together, and then from time to time a small one single species which disappears, or very few of them disappear, and there is some kind of domino effect that the species which interact with them disappear, and and again, exactly like when I was dropping one grain of sand, then somehow there were neighboring sites which were almost unstable, and this very small instability propagates and produces a huge event. Okay, so let me just mention what the model more precisely was that physicists have looked at, and here I just mentioned two papers, but there are many, many of them in the theoretical physics literature, and the model I discuss is the Back-Snepen model. And the idea of the model is extremely simple, and it produces pictures, as we will see, which look very much like what you see in the real world. So they say, let's consider a system, and each species in the system is just so the number of species is fixed, and each species is characterized by some number. So you take some random number at the beginning, and this number is just a number between 0 and 1. So each species has a random number, and now the evolution step is the following. At each time step, you look at all the species, and you decide that the one which has the smallest number, this XI is some kind of fitness or adequacy to the world, whatever you want to call it. And then they decide that the one which has the lowest fitness is eliminated, but it's not eliminated alone. It is eliminated with another species, which is supposed to be another species which it interacts. So if one species disappears, then maybe its predator disappears, or another species which is linked to it disappears. So the one with the smallest XI disappears, and then together with it, another species disappears. And then they are replaced by two new species with two new random numbers, which says that just you had n species together, and then you have to fill the niches by new species. So this is how the model works. And let's see what you get out of that. So from time to time, a species disappears, the other one disappears, and then very quickly the thing settled and nothing happens, exactly like when you drop a grain of sand. But from time to time, this small instability propagates, and then you get huge events. And this is what is shown in this paper by Back and Snepen and some co-workers. Is here on the top, you have a picture which is supposed to be similar to the picture that I had shown you previously, which is a record of the true events which occurred in history about extinction events. So I don't know exactly where they took it from, but more or less you have these big peaks with some big events with huge mass extinction. And on the bottom, it is just the curve that you get in their model. So again, you get big avalanches. From time to time, many species in their model disappear. And you see, there is no need of any earthquake or meteorite or whatever. They just are produced by themselves, just by the dynamics of these models. Another curve I can show, just to finish, is maybe a slightly different model that Newman and Roberts look at. And here, again, they look at the size of extinctions as a function of time, exactly for a model which is extremely similar. Again, you have no external event at all, and you see huge, so the extinction size is probably the number of species which have disappeared, and you see these huge events which occur, and small events, and this is a curve again which looks very much like earthquakes that we have seen before. Okay, so I should stop here.
Vous venez d'entendre Bernard Derrida, membre de l'Académie des sciences. Il exposait quelques modèles d'événements climatiques. Il était précédé par Philippe Naveau du laboratoire des sciences du climat et de l'environnement. Il présentait les méthodes statistiques pour l'analyse des extrêmes climatiques. On marque une pause avant d'écouter les trois intervenants suivants, Hervé Le Treut, Jean-Claude André et Geoffroy Bolton. À tout de suite. Nous poursuivons la retransmission du colloque Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007. Vous entendrez Jean-Claude André, membre de l'Académie des sciences. Il travaille au Centre européen de recherche et de formation avancée en calcul scientifique. Il développera dans sa communication la question des cyclones tropicaux et l'incidence directe des changements climatiques. Geoffroy Bolton de l'École de géosciences à l'Université d'Édimbourg en Grande-Bretagne clôturera cette quatrième partie en évoquant pour sa part les événements glaciaires extrêmes. Mais auparavant, débutons par la communication d'Hervé Le Treut, climatologue au laboratoire de météorologie dynamique, membre de l'Académie des sciences. Son intervention porte sur les observations et modélisations des composantes atmosphériques des changements hydrologiques. Toutes ces communications à suivre sont en anglais.
I will focus more on the more regular part of this water cycle, which nevertheless can have also extreme consequences. I will talk a little about it and try to discuss one of the important elements of this regular cycle, which is what we call the Hadley cells. We focus strongly on this tropical component of the cycle. The aim of the talk is to describe the mechanisms by which the cycle may change when climate changes. And so I'll use, in the context of this talk, a number of results connected with the IPCC scenarios. So this is a kind of warming, global warming, which is associated with the IPCC scenarios. So each scenario has a color which corresponds to some level of CO2 or other gases emission and produces a global warming which may go from 2 to 5 or more degrees at the end of the century. These scenarios were those of the third IPCC report in 2001. Number of results also will come from the models run for the last report, one released in January, which basically have used the same scenarios with the results also similar. So you have a long continuity of models which have been used for the IPCC with the same scenarios of CO2 emissions. And I will show some of those results and try to interpret them in the terms of precipitation change and try to focus on the mechanisms which bring precipitation changes, especially in the tropics. So this is the kind of pattern that one can see when we try to use those models to assess precipitation changes. You have two French models here. IPSL is models in Paris, and CNRM is a model of Météo France. With the two models share a number of things, in particular the ocean. So they are not completely disconnected, but they have a very different representation of the atmosphere. One from LMD, from my lab, and the other one from the Met Office Arpège model for CNRM. And when you look at the global patterns, you see that there is more precipitation along the equator. These are annual means in a warmer world, and it's a change in precipitation. And there is less precipitation, on the contrary, in the subtropics. This is the yellow part, which corresponds to the belt of deserts here in these regions, and again more precipitation at mid latitudes. So one of the main thrust of this talk will be trying to explain this kind of patterns, which in fact looks very much like the pattern of observed precipitation or observed condensation in the atmosphere for real climate. This is the kind of image of the circulation you may see from satellites with condensation in the equatorial regions and less condensation in the subtropical latitudes, and then again precipitation at mid latitudes. Can see that in global means, you have more precipitation in the equator and less precipitation in subtropics, and again more precipitation at mid latitudes. So I think I'd like before I try to say how this tropical pattern changes, say a few words about the way the circulation and system operates at global scale in terms of link between thermodynamics, dynamics, and water cycle. The one key feature, if one looks at the tropical area, is that we have a temperature which is in fact very homogeneous between about 30 south to 30 north. This is the temperature as a function of latitude. And reversely, when you look at the water vapor in the atmosphere, this is an image, instantaneous image of the water vapor at 10 kilometers, 10 to 15 kilometer altitude, in terms of relative water vapor. Blue is about 80% water vapor, and the white is less than 10% water vapor. So you see that we have a strong, strongly opposed image. In terms of temperature, tropical area is rather homogeneous. And there is very strong dynamical reasons. The atmosphere wants to be, what we say, geostrophic, maintain equilibrium with the Coriolis force, and it needs for that to be flat in terms of temperature. And we have, on the contrary, very strong contrast in terms of humidity in the atmosphere, with very dry areas being very close to very humid area. So this can be explained by the existence of strong ascending motions. And you have here these motions as observed. This is a classical climatology by Ort and Peixoto, where you can see the annual transports above. So I'll try to show you. This is in latitude. It goes from South Pole to North Pole. And this is altitude. So it's a transect in the atmosphere. It's actually a mean in longitude of the circulation. And these are the the cells which you can see in the tropics. There is one thing which is very striking, is that when you look at the limit of those cells, so you have ascending motions here near the equator, and then descending motions in the subtropics, the limit of those cells varies very little throughout the year. This is annual means. December, January, February, which is winter of the Northern Hemisphere, and summer of the Northern Hemisphere. And you see that the ascending region, on the contrary, varies very much with a very strong winter cell and a weaker summer cell. The kind of image which corresponds then to these tropical circulations is this one. You have a rather homogeneous temperature field and superimposed a circulation with which define a warm so the temperature in the atmosphere is rather homogeneous with an ascending region which is a moist region and descending region which is a dry region because air gets dry when it goes up and then when it goes down it's in the form of dry air. So these cells are the cells which we are going to study when they vary in terms of in the context of climate change. We can show, and I skip that, and there's a paper we've done some years ago, that in fact those images may apply to two kind of scales, the large scale, the one I'm discussing, also smaller scales, with a separation between those two scales. And the existence of those ascending and descending regions makes it very tempting to have those simplified view of the tropical circulation, separating either a large number of different vertical velocity or simply the ascending and the descending regions. And that's one framework, and I will go back on it, on which you can compare the properties of the atmosphere. On one side, the atmosphere in the ascending region and in the descending region. So if we go back now to this issue of precipitation changes, what we see is that in a modified climate, in fact, everything looks as if the global pattern was simply reinforced in terms of precipitation. We have precipitation increasing where we already have precipitation, and we have precipitation decreasing where we have already dry areas. And an idea which is very common is that this is some kind of increase in the tropical circulation. And in fact, this is not exactly how things happen. If we look at the Hadley circulation strength, this was done by Guillaume Gastineau in our lab, a PhD student. This is the strength of the circulation for the stronger cell in June, July, August. And in gray, this is the simulation by the different models used for the IPCC exercise. One thing you can notice is that those models are quite different. This is one of the basic parameter which describes climate. And we don't have a perfect knowledge and a perfect presentation of these basic mechanisms, and quite different representation of the Hadley cell. And then superimposed, you have a number of small results showing the modification of this Hadley cell strength when there is an increase in CO2. And in fact, we use those scenarios I've shown at the point where we reach doubling of the CO2. And what you see is that in general, the Hadley cell circulation tends to diminish in strength. Most of these smaller round or triangles are within the gray shading. And the reason for that is that, in fact, one of the reasons why the Hadley cell circulates is that it has to bring energy to the poles. And when you look at the kind of patterns concerning precipitation that we can observe in climate change scenarios, these are the scenarios for the last IPCC report, you see an increase of temperature in the polar areas, which is several reasons. One which is often advocated is increased albedo when snow melts, and then there is also something which is linked with a larger stability of the air in polar regions. And the fact that the polar regions tend to warm more than the low latitude regions means that the circulation of the atmosphere needs to transfer less energy to the poles. So it will circulate a bit less efficiently, and that we see also when we look at the circulation strengths in winter. Generally, models tend to show a decrease of the Hadley circulation strengths in winter for a warmer world. So it goes in the opposite direction of what is commonly assumed. And in fact, what happens is that we have an increase in the ascending branch of the Hadley circulation. We have an increase in the precipitation, but the circulation is decreasing. So if I go back to this small cartoon I had at the beginning, what we see in a warmer world is a circulation, this arrow, which is smaller, but the amount of water in a warmer world, which is being transported, is larger, just because the temperature means a higher value of relative humidity. And then the precipitation is stronger. And also, what the other side effect is that as precipitation goes higher up in the atmosphere, the drying effect, there is more condensation that brings it even higher, and there is a drying which reflects itself in larger dry areas in the descending regions. So this intensification of the precipitation patterns is a result of a compensation between two opposite effects. And in fact, what we see is that we have a slower mean circulation with a more active local circulation. And this is what will bring more precipitation in the ascending regions of the Adlisel. So this is the reason why there is some uncertainty about the model results. First is that where each time you have compensating phenomena, then there is some level of disagreement between models. This can be expressed by any diagram. So I like this one because it's the first intercomparison of coupled models, and I think it's still very valid. You see that models do agree in terms of global patterns for precipitation with this increase in the near the equator and decrease in subtropical areas, but in terms of detail changes, they do not increase. They do not agree as much. Then there is one question, which is, will the limit of this Adlisel change in a changing world? Because this will have a very strong impact on precipitation. Well, what I've shown is, a change in the water cycle with, in fact, a slower circulation, but without any change on the sphere of this circulation. When we look at this in detail, so that was done also by Guillaume Gastineau, but these are also been published by Liu et al. We see that there is a displacement of the Adlisel boundary, so this boundary at 30 south or 30 north, which is associated with its weakening. What we have is our weaker circulations, which expand a bit more to the north, or to the south, for the northern limit to the north, for the southern limit to the south, and with quite a wide range of displacement for the different models. Theoretical explanations which are still uncertain, and also a limited change. This is 1.5 degrees, so it's not in degree of latitude. So it's a change in the domain, which is about 100 kilometers. It's not a very huge change in terms of precipitation change. So we have another effect. The limit of this area of this precipitation associated changes associated with change precipitation patterns associated with the Adlisel can also change, but quite moderately. Then this is basically the result shows the same thing. Now, there are two things I would like to emphasize before I conclude. One is that, of course, this is only part of the story. There are lots of other effects which are connected with local circulation, what we call modes of circulation, and which reflect here by differences between two models. You see that we have differences over Africa, for example, or over the monsoon. And when people look at precipitation changes at regional scales, is a study done over South America by Carolina Vera and co-authors, and that's been done during the last IPCC exercise over different parts of the world with different models. And we see two French models on this one and this one, and we see different seasons, and we see huge difference in terms of precipitation changes at regional scale. which is due to a large number of monsoon effects, which do not agree between different models. Now, another thing which I will not have time to touch in details is the fact that those changes are very much linked with the change in climate sensitivity mechanism, because when we look at this image of the world, where we have an increase here in humidity in this area and a moister world here and a drier world here, we have the basis of a lot of feedback mechanisms which will entrain and modify climate change. So I will just insist on this diagram. In this region where we add moisture to an already moist atmosphere, we tend to enter in some runaway greenhouse effect, which tends to amplify indefinitely by itself, but which is in fact moderated by this dry area, which can emit infrared radiation to the sky. So these same processes I've described are also controlling in a way the sensitivity of the atmosphere to the increase of greenhouse effect through different feedbacks, water vapor feedback associated with changes in greenhouse effect, and cloud feedbacks also associated with changes in greenhouse effect, but also albedo effect of the clouds. So one of the thing which is one of the key problem to which we are faced is, can we reduce those uncertainties? And I think that's where, and I won't have time to do it as much as I thought, data enter. And what I've tried to show is that we have, in fact, a complex set of processes which has embedded in some circulation patterns. And what we can do increasingly now is try to use the larger number of data which become available to try to disentangle the circulation part of the problem and the physical, the process part of the problem, in particular in terms of cloud processes, moist processes. And we have got in the last years a large number of satellite measurements looking at many parameters from a cloud point of view, water vapor point of view, and we have now rational and data to get into those processes in a more clever way than we did before. So to read my conclusions, and I've not covered everything which is in this conclusion, we have uncertainties, we have a number of mechanisms which explain precipitation changes. They tend to become clearer than they were a few years ago. There are uncertainties about these precipitation changes, and we begin to have a number of patterns and a number of concepts which probably will brings us to a closer and a more constrained view of the sensitivity of the climate system. But the climate system will remain complex and partly unpredictable, and also at mid-latitudes, which I have not touched in this talk.
The next speaker is Jean-Claude André from the Academy of Science. He is maître de conférence in École Polytechnique too. He made many studies on meteorology and dynamics of atmosphere and climate. And he is now the director of CERFAX, the Centre Européen de Recherche et de Formation Avancée en Calcul Scientifique, which I think he has created. And he was before director of the Recherche of the research in Météo France, our Met Office in France. He has published a lot of works and papers, And I remember when I was in the USA, we were always at the, you were very young, just after your PhD, and everybody speak about your paper on boundary layer, and it was, but from this period, you have done a lot of work on ocean-atmosphere interaction. So please.
Merci, Katia. Thank you for remembering the good old times. So my slides are in French. I'll try to speak in English. So the easy part of the talk is just to ask the question, is there any relationship between tropical cyclones and climate change? So that's the easy part. Now, the difficult part is try to answer that question. And what I will use for that is a number of results which have been published in the last report of the IPCC, and also some other results which are not yet published, and most of them are coming from Fabrice Chauvin and Jean-François Verrier, who are climatologists in Toulouse at CNRM, and Stéphane Algat, who is an economist also dealing with climate change. So, first of all, of course, we have to remember ourselves that the tropical cyclones are very intense systems which are associated with high winds, intense precipitation, and which can, of course, produce very large damages in terms of death toll, in terms of damages for infrastructure, and, of course, they induce a number of ecological perturbations. How do they work? I think it's important to recall a few facts about tropical cyclones if we want to understand their future in a changing climate. First of all, they develop only if the temperature of the sea surface is above a certain threshold, which is around 26 degrees C, 26.5. So the cyclone can develop only if there is enough energy available at the surface. But that's not the end of the story, because there are factors which can either inhibit or favor the development of the cyclones once the thermodynamic conditions at the surface are favorable enough. And, of course, the vertical thermal structure of the atmosphere is of importance. The more stable it is, the less favorable it is for the development of tropical cyclones. But also a factor which is a little more difficult to deal with is a vertical wind shear, that is the vertical variation of horizontal wind. The more vertical variation of horizontal wind you have with height, the less favorable it is for the development of cyclones. And this is something which you will see towards the end of the talk. This is quite a difficult factor to control and to predict, and this explains some of the difficulties which we have to answer that simple question. A few facts also. Every year, there are something like 70 to 80 tropical cyclones which develop over the globe. Among those 70 to 80 cyclones which develop every year, basically something of the order of 10 are developing in the tropical Atlantic. And my talk will concern mostly those tropical cyclones, because it's a region where the experimental data are available and where it's possible to do better analysis. So the question is there any increase in cyclone over the last 10 years? An increase either in number of cyclones or an increase in the intensity of cyclones? And if there is such an increase, is it associated with climate change or not? Or do we simply have to face a world which exhibits a large natural variability, and we are just experiencing presently regular fluctuation without having to call for a changing climate? How to answer this question? We have two type of data to deal with. Is a direct observation of cyclones, and this is not so easy. It might seem easy to say, okay, we observe cyclones. It's not so easy. And I will also say a few words about indirect observations, that is, things which you can infer from the damages which are being done by the cyclones. So first, dealing with direct observation of the cyclone. So this is a map over the last 50 years, basically, of cyclones being observed in the Atlantic. And, of course, as you can see, that starting during the mid-90s, there seems to be an increase in the number of tropical cyclones. I remember giving that talk 1 year ago when the number of cyclones for 2006 was not known, of course. So without that, see if I can find. Without the last point corresponding to the 2006 data, then of course the answer was okay. There seems to be a large increase in tropical cyclones. But if you look on a slightly longer time scale, that is, if you go back to the mid 1800s. Then, of course, you know, the increase which can be seen today might also be compared with some peaks which could be observed much earlier in the late 1800s or around 1930 or 1970. So, basically, are we dealing with a system which is changing, or are we dealing with a system which is exhibiting natural variability? That's a question. And if you try to get rid of some of the small time scale variation, if you try to make some time averaging, say about 10 years, then you end up with such a figure where, of course, there might appear to be some increase in the later year, but this increase is not that correlated with the beginning of the real warming of the atmosphere, which really started to took place in the 70s or something like that. So the question is really open, and what can be concluded from direct observation is that it's difficult, because when you go back in time, we may have lost cyclones, because cyclones could not be observed from space as they are presently. So some cyclones, the one which didn't affect populated area, could have been just unobserved. So there is a bias toward an underestimation of cyclones toward the earlier periods. So it's difficult, and we should be cautious. So another possibility is try to have an idea of what's happening in studying the damages which cyclones are responsible for. And in order to do that, you have to estimate, in a way, the potential damages a cyclone can make. And of course, this is basically the results of the integral over time and space of the work which a cyclone can exert on structure and nature, that is the cube of the velocity. Of course, it's totally impossible to compute such a parameter from available data, but you can just approach that power dissipation by a power dissipation index, where you just basically try to have an estimate of the maximum velocity which could be observed in a cyclone. This is the type of data which you can access to, and try to integrate that over the life duration of the cyclone, which is also another parameter which can be reasonably obtained. If you do that, and if you plot, that's something which was done by Kerry Emanuel in the United States, if you do that, and if you plot this, what is called on the figure, the Atlantic Power Dissipation Index, PDI, that's a dash curve, you see that, in fact, there seems to be an effect of increase of this power dissipation index over time, and especially in the recent years. And on top of that, this increase seems to be well correlated with the increase of sea surface temperature in the same region that those data are corresponding to the Atlantic, tropical Atlantic. Okay, but if that effect is real, then you can ask yourself, and some US scientists have done that, and some French scientists have done that, if there is an increase in the power dissipation index of cyclones, we should see that in the increase of the damages which are being done by the cyclones. So there are some studies, And in fact, those studies gave rise to a lot of debate within the scientific community. Some people arguing for increase, some people arguing for stationarity. So let's look at their respective arguments. So Pilkey and others said if the PDI is increasing, then damages should also increase. So we should be able to see that in studying the damages which have been noted over time. But of course, we should correct. We should correct those damages for inflation. We should correct those damages for the fact that the largest number of people are being exposed to cyclones. We should correct that because the value of the goods which can be affected by cyclones are also increased. And if you do all those corrections, and this is what Pilkey and others did, then you end up with the conclusion that, in fact, there is no real increase of the damages produced by cyclones. That is, probably, cyclones are still are not increasing themselves. But if you do that, you basically forget to correct for other factors, which would go in the other direction. Other factors which would go in the other direction are, for example, due to the fact that more and more people are constructing dams, are constructing houses in a better way, so the damages of future cyclones can be reduced. And as you all also know, whenever a cyclone is coming, the forecast usually a few days before, or at least 24 hours before, is explaining people that they should stay home and protect themselves and so on. So there are strong measures which also tends to reduce the damages caused by the cyclone just because we know they are going to happen. So the first conclusion of what I just very briefly review is that basically we don't know. We don't know because the observation from the real world are biased because we don't have satellite observation earlier than 30 or 40 years ago, and we cannot basically infer anything from damages because we are not to a point where we can correct accurately for all factors. So looking at the real world is of little help. And the question, of course, arises immediately that if you cannot infer anything from looking at the real world today, what could we say for the future? So I will say a few words about that. The only way, of course, to look at what is going to happen in the future is to use numerical simulation. That is, take a climate model of the type which Hervé Letreux just reported about, and try to run this model in future condition with increased CO2 concentration and so on. Of course, we have to choose a particular scenario. Is it going to be a scenario with a large concentration of carbon dioxide, with high warming or not? What I should say is that if you take the climate model, the present climate models, they have a resolution, spatial resolution. They have grid points, if you like, which are not very close to each other, and not close enough anyway to be able to describe a tropical cyclone. So basically, when you're looking at what climate model says for the future, you're not looking at real cyclones, real numerical cyclones in numerical models. You're looking at some proxies which can give you an idea of the cyclonic activity. This is why I will rely here on an index which was based on an earlier index by Cray and which has been improved by Jean-François Royer and colleagues recently, where basically you try to have an index accounting for both the thermal effects and the way they found is just to look at the convective precipitation, which is a good composite indicators for all thermal effects. And you have also, of course, to include what I said earlier, things which are related to the dynamic structure of the atmosphere, and especially including the vertical shear, that is the vertical gradient of horizontal wind. So if you do that, You can first of all look at what the index says for the real world, that is at the top figures, where you can of course recognize South America, Australia, and the more reddish the curve means that those are regions where you have cyclogenesis, and of course if you get to a more bluish color, that is the cyclogenesis is much less intense. So that's an estimation of what is happening today, and below you find fifteen boxes, which show what actual climate models are says for the same index for the present climate. So what you can first see from very roughly from looking at this picture is that, of course, there are relationship between what the climate model says for the actual climate and what the actual climate is. Of course, there are more cyclogenesis in the in what we call the warm pools around Australia, Indonesia. Of course, there is more cyclogenesis in the tropical Atlantic. But you can also see that going from one model to the other, you have a lot of differences. They might be related to some factors which Hervé Le Treut just discussed. But nevertheless, those indices give more or less realistic description of the region where the cyclogenesis is taking place. And that's basically an index which you can use to look at what future climate is going to be with respect to tropical cyclones. I'm doing well? Okay. Now, if you look at what these 15 models are going to tell you for the end of the 21st century, so what I'm going to show is a variation in cyclogenesis rate between the late 21st century and the late 20th century. That is what is the difference in cyclogenesis between today and the end of of our present century. Okay, if you have reddish colors, means that you will have more cyclogenesis. If you have bluish color, means that you have probably will have less cyclogenesis. So I will just push the button and let the 15 models give you their answers to that. So see that there are some common factors, but there are also a lot of differences. Let me go back, for example, you have some reddish color for this particular model, but this is also true for other models, where you see tropical cyclone developing in the South Atlantic, which would be something brand new, because no cyclones, I think only one cyclone has been observed in the Southern Atlantic, as far as we know. So those different models give different answers. And if you collect all of them, just to have just have an overview, this is what you end up with. So it's probably more reddish than bluish. That is probably a tendency to develop more cyclones. But you see that the picture is not that very clear. In fact, if you look in more detail, which I won't have time to do here, but if you look in more detail and try to understand why you have those patterns within a particular model, you end up with a conclusion that these type of patterns are nicely related to the variation in the sea surface temperature distribution. So each particular model has its own logics relating variation in the sea surface temperature patterns to the patterns of cyclogenesis. But these logics varies from one model to the other. So the second conclusion which I can draw from that is that that might be an augmentation in an increase in cyclogenesis in the Pacific, although in some the main feature to underline is that it's very model dependent. What you can get is very model dependent. So can we go one step further? So going one step further would be to really have models which can produce numerical cyclones, that is objects which can be described of cyclones, which have which have the eye, which have the strong winds region, and so on and so on. How far are we from that? Just a few results. I give you result of simulations which have been done with a fairly high spatial resolution, 50 kilometers horizontal resolution. It's not high enough, but it's fairly high for climate modeling. And here you have what, you know, the cyclone tracks which are simulated in this model for the present period, that is from 1970 to 1999. And over the 10 year, this 10-year period, this model with a 50-kilometer resolution and corresponding to the B2 scenarios, where the increase in the greenhouse gases is relatively moderate. It's a scenario B2, but first thing I'm showing is the actual climate, and that's 109 trajectories which can be identified in the model, and with the same model, but for scenario B2, 100 years later, you have this type of cyclone tracks, 120 cyclone trajectories, so which would mean basically that would be some slight increase, and maybe some slight eastward displacement of the region where the cyclogenesis is taking place. So that is one model with fairly high resolution corresponding to a moderate greenhouse warming scenario. Now, let's do the same thing with basically the same spatial resolution, but for a scenario which corresponds to a much higher content in greenhouse gases, that is to a larger warming. So you would expect maybe to have more cyclones because you have more warming, more water in the atmosphere, more water to extract from the ocean to give back to the atmosphere and so on. And if you do that, for the present time, you have, this is done on 30 years, so you have to divide the number of trajectories by 3 to compare with the previous ones. And you have 125, which is a little more for the present. But if you look at the end of the century, then you end up with the conclusion that there is a decrease in that particular model run. There would be a decrease in the number of cyclones being generated. So even when you go to higher resolution, you get conflicting results results which are difficult to interpret because you would get more cyclone let's phrase it the other way. You would get less cyclone in a warmer world, which doesn't always correspond to what you would expect. So basically, that's my conclusion. Model projections are still very uncertain. What we can say in general is that the total number of cyclogenesis is not likely to change very much, but we don't know that well. Some models, but maybe the one which have the highest spatial resolution, some models tend to predict a small increase in convective precipitation. That is, maybe you have heard, you know, this very sketchy conclusion from the IPCC that the number of cyclones wouldn't change, but the cyclones would be more intense. This is based on these very, very tiny facts, which I just showed. And of course, the modification of the cyclogenesis, this is something which hopefully is there and which gives us some hope to go further, that there is a physical link, apparently, between cyclogenesis and the sea surface temperature patterns. So that's probably the way which we should follow to go a little further. And of course, we need to increase basically the models, and we think that one key improvement would be to have a much higher spatial resolution so that you can really have numerical cyclones within your numerical climate model. Otherwise, you're tied with indirect methods for inferring the occurrence of tropical cyclones. I think I should close here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Notre prochain et dernier speaker de la journée sera Sir Geoffrey Boulton, qui est Regius Professor of Geology and Mineralogy at the School of Geosciences, University of Edinburgh. Sir Geoffrey Boulton is involved in the Cryosphere program, a program whose aim is to understand what will happen
in places in the world where there is presently a melting of ice, of glaciers, especially with regards to human population safety. Sir Geoffrey Bolton, you have the floor.
I'm not going to present you with any high-level conclusions or a philosophical discussion of what is and what is not extreme. I'm going to simply give you some phenomenology to describe some of the extreme events in glacier systems that we have become aware of. And the reason is because many of them we have not seen before. Many of these phenomena are new phenomena. They're extreme in space and they're extreme in time. And I want to discriminate for convenience between two sorts of extreme event, those which we believe are characteristic of large ice sheets. And you know that the Earth now has two large ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, although in its past it has had more, and those that occur in valley glaciers. The former tend to be low-frequency, high-magnitude events with the potential for a global impact, and the latter tend to be high-frequency, low-magnitude events with local rather than global impacts. The behavior of glaciers, no matter what scale, is coupled into the global climate system, and one might think of their behavior as being largely driven by climate. But in fact, the behavior of most glaciers is also very strongly influenced by internal dynamic changes. And one of the reasons why those internal dynamic changes are so important is simply because the time scale of change is relatively low compared certainly with the atmosphere and in many cases with the operation of the ocean. So time lags are extremely important. But one of the things that the geological record tells us is that the nature of dynamic glacier dynamics changes as the climate mode changes. If we look at ice sheets 20,000 years ago and ice sheets at the present day, they almost certainly behaved in quite different ways. And one of the principal reason for that is that an absolutely vital part of the behavior of an ice sheet or a small glacier is dictated by a thermal instability. It's the fact that the flow law for ice is temperature dependent. And if you step across a threshold, which is the melting point, the behavior of ice changes really very strongly. So let me first of all talk about ice sheets, and I'll first of all illustrate how that behavior changes. Have I got a pointer here? The top two figures and the lower two figures contrast two different sorts of ice sheet. In the first, the conditions are very cold, such that the melting point is not reached at the base of the ice sheet, because of course ice gets warmer downwards. And in the bottom two, the melting point temperatures are achieved at the base. When that happens, a rather peculiar thing occurs, the ice begins to slide. Most solids moving over, most plastic solids or fluids moving over a rigid surface tend to have a stationary basal boundary condition, but ice slides over its bed. And when that condition is reached, then the ice sheet becomes much more dynamic. It moves much more quickly and much more readily. Now we have to contrast the behavior of ice sheets in the modern world, shown here below, which shows one ice sheet, that of Greenland in the top right-hand corner. Antarctica is hidden down below, and the Earth of, say, 20,000 years ago, when we had four ice sheets, one on Eurasia, one on North America, in addition to the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets. If we look at the evolution of temperature regime over the Greenland ice sheet, which is shown by the top diagram here, over the last 100,000 years, then you see very clearly this contrast between the coldest part of the glacial period,
where we have extremely rapid temperature oscillations over Greenland, which contrast dramatically with the last 10,000 years when the temperature oscillations over Greenland have had very, very low amplitude. The bottom diagram shows the extent of the European ice sheet over the same time period. And so we have an ice sheet in Europe that is contemporary with the strong oscillations that we see over Greenland. And then during the warm, or the succeeding interglacial, the present interglacial, then we have relatively stable conditions and no ice sheet over Europe. The stability of ice sheets can be represented very simply. The vertical axis, the nominal vertical axis on this diagram, attempts to show the thermal stability of an ice sheet. And we can place the Earth's various ice sheets in that stability domain. The Antarctic ice sheet would be by far and away the most stable, thermally stable. The Greenland ice sheet next. The North American ice sheet when it existed next. The European ice sheet when it existed next. And the British ice sheet least stable. And when I say thermally unstable, I mean thermally unstable for two reasons. First of all, that if the thermal condition is a warm thermal condition, then the mass balance on the surface of the ice sheet will tend to be negative. But equally, when the thermal condition is a warm one, then the ice sheet is more dynamic. The blue color, the blue horizontal stripe, is intended to represent a key thermal boundary during a glacial period, where you see the Antarctic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet are far above that thermal boundary and therefore very stable. But the European and the British ice sheet were relatively much less stable, much more dynamic. If we then shift into the interglacial, shown by the brown band, the conditions change such that the North American ice sheet, the European ice sheet, and the British ice sheet disappear, but the Greenland ice sheet then becomes thermally unstable in a way that it was not during the glacial period. So its mode has changed. And of course, one of the large questions is whether in future, marked by the red band, this limit of thermal stability might begin seriously to influence the Antarctic ice sheet, either in its mass balance or more likely in its dynamics. And those are very large questions. Now, modern ice sheets have a very distinctive dynamic structure that has only really been discovered in the last 30 to 40 years. And that is that their flow is largely dictated by fast-flowing streams that flow through them. Both of these images are from Antarctica. The lowest one shows velocity contoured in color banding of an ice stream in East Antarctica with the velocities in the terminal area in excess of 1 kilometer per year. Whereas on the flanks of the ice stream, the velocities are the order of 10, 20, 30, 40 meters per year. Sorry. If we look at Antarctic flow velocities, the dark colors, the black colors, are in the ice divide regions where the flows are extremely slow, and the white colors are in ice streams where the flow velocities are in excess of 0.25 kilometer per year, and in many cases rise to in excess of 1 kilometer per year. These ice streams are vital dynamic elements. Although they comprise only about 15% of the total area of the ice sheet, they discharge about 85% of the mass. So if the ice sheet starts to decay, it's the ice streams that will do the damage. They will transport the mass outwards towards the ocean. Now, this was an animation of satellite images from Western Greenland showing... Actually, no, this particular one that didn't work was an animation of the European ice sheet during the last glacial period, When I recognized it wasn't going to work, I think I put in some other slides to show it. This is some geological evidence which indicates where the ice streams were during the last glacial period in Europe. And one of the distinctive attributes of these ice streams is they appear to have been very much wider, very much broader than those we see either in Antarctica or in Greenland. However, this is a simulation model, which I had tried to animate for you, which shows a snapshot of the flow velocities in the ice sheet at one point in its history. The red areas show high velocities, and the arrows are flow vectors. And these are basal simulated basal velocities. And you can see that the areas of fast flow are very limited indeed, very narrow. I mean, order 10 to 15 kilometers, whereas the geological evidence suggests that the ice streams are very much bigger. That, of course, is the exception is in the southern Baltic region, where we have this enormous ice stream, which has a dominant role in conditioning the form of the ice sheet. But if we then look at the way in which those ice streams change through time, these are some time snapshots from 1917 and 15,000 years before present of the same area of the ice sheet. And what you can see very clearly is the ice streams are unstable. They shift. They move from location to location. And in fact, it's that, we think, that creates the impression of these very wide ice streams. They were never wide, but actually they represent the pathways across which ice streams fluctuated. But these fluctuations are not merely fluctuations in the dynamic pattern, they're also fluctuations of the margin. In fact, we can tune these models by adjusting the temperature such that we can make them oscillate, advancing and retreating on time, almost any time scale you like, between about 500 years, which is the fastest, and about 5,000 years. And on the western margin, continental margin, western Norway, of course, then major extensions of the ice sheet, even though only limited in time, would have given rise to very large fluxes of icebergs. And we know from the geological record in the North Atlantic that from time to time, the North Atlantic was like a Parisian traffic jam. It was full of icebergs, which can only have come from both the Northern European and the American ice sheet. So we have in the European ice sheet during the last glacial period a very highly dynamic ice sheet, much more dynamic than the ice sheets that we have in the present world. So let's start to look at some of the present world's ice sheets. This is the Greenland ice sheet, and this shows two simulations, but based on real data, of the maximum extension of the melt zone of the ice sheet in 1992 and 2002. And indeed, those snapshots are actually characteristic of the years around 1990 and the recent years since the turn of the millennium, and you can see how it's extended. If you then utilize scenarios of future change, and the top right, there are some very simple scenarios of greenhouse gas atmospheric concentrations. If we look at future scenarios and we compute the change in mass of the ice sheet as a consequence of change in the area of melting and accumulation, then we conclude that if we want to get rid of the ice sheet entirely, even under very high greenhouse gas concentrations, it will take about 5,000 years. And the other scenarios are for smaller concentrations and the top right-hand one is 3,000 years AD with a concentration of 750 parts per million. The bottom right-hand diagram shows the sea level impact. So the almost complete deglaciation of Greenland at the bottom right would produce a sea level rise of near eight meters. But the rate of sea level rise in the present day will be extremely slow over a very long period of time. Now, this is the second animation that you won't see, and it would have shown one of the large ice streams of West Greenland. The animation was composed, I have it on my computer and I can show some of you if you're interested later. The animation is composed of a series of satellite images, and what they show very clearly is the way in which in the last 30 years one of these major ice streams draining the western part of the ice sheet has been speeding up. And as it speeds up, of course, it creates very large numbers of icebergs. The iceberg flux increases. We're now very confident what's happening in Greenland. It's getting thicker in the middle and thinner at the edges. The reason it's getting thicker in the middle, of course, is because storms are now penetrating much more deeply into the center of the ice sheet and accumulation rates have been rising. The reason it's getting thinner at the margins is because it's flowing faster and therefore ice is being evacuated rapidly. That, of course, steepens the slope on the ice sheet, which increases the driving stress, which means that the rate of flow will tend to increase. Now, one of the things that we have seen for the first time in recent years are very large lakes which form seasonally in summer on the surface of the ice sheet, many tens, in some cases hundreds of kilometres back from the margin. That has not been seen prior to the last few years. What we also see is that many of those lakes, even quite large ones, drain at some point during the summer or early winter period. Now, that water can only go to the bed. If it goes to the bed, of course, what it will do is drive up water pressures at the ice bed interface and decrease the friction at the interface. And it may well be that this is one of the principal reasons why the flow velocities of the ice sheet has been increasing in recent years. If we run a different sort of model, in which instead of merely inquiring about the rate at which the ice sheet will melt because of warming climate, and if we have a model in which we put some basal dynamics in, some basal physics, in which we drive up water pressures at the ice bed interface and reduce friction, then we get a result which is very different from the previous result that I showed you. This is some output from one of the models which shows two of the large ice streams in northeast Greenland in the central diagram, which shows the distribution of velocity, shows big ice streams in northeast Greenland and west Greenland, which are enormously influential in evacuating ice. And it's in particular those ice streams that we've tried to model. And if we do that, we get a rather different sort of answer to the one we had before. These are the same sorts of global warming scenarios. And in this one, the horizontal scale now starts at the year 2000 at the bottom left and goes to 2350. You see ice volume and freshwater discharge. The blue simulations are the simulations which are simply surface melting simulations. The red simulations are the ones where flow dynamics are included. And you can see that the rate of ice volume reduction and the rate of freshwater discharge are dramatically greater in the dynamic case. And indeed, the rate of sea level rise is increased by a factor of at least 10 under that sort of scenario. And these are simulations which show the form of the ice sheet that we might expect it under those dynamic cases in 700 years on the left and I think 950 years on the right. These are reconstructions that have been compiled recently by Hans Erlemans of the global sea level change in centimetres over the last 200 years. The total increase has been a relatively small one. Much of that, of course, is accounted for by thermal expansion of the oceans. But if we superimpose a Greenland melting driven by dynamic change on this, then the prognostication is a sea level increase at the rate of about a metre to a metre and a half per year. Sorry. Let me say that again. A metre to a metre and a half per century. So you can relax. But of course, that's an extremely serious rise and threatens many coastal areas that are currently not threatened. Very quickly, let me say a few things about small glaciers, mountain glaciers. And one of the most important ranges that we should try to understand are the Himalayan ranges. The Himalayas contain about 12,000 cubic kilometres of glacier ice and cover seasonally 1.5 million square kilometres of the land area. They're complicated climatically because the western Himalaya receives westerly winds and is dominated by westerly winds, such that the accumulation of snow and ice takes place primarily in winter, whereas the eastern and central Himalayas are primarily have their health determined, or glacier health is mainly determined by monsoon precipitation, and most of the monsoon precipitation, of course, is in the summertime and not in the wintertime. These are a series of images in Ladakh, in the Western Himalayas, which were chosen over the last 30 years to represent, to be representative of the seasons in those years. I mean, it's a very crude representation, but I think it helps. That's the snow cover and glacier extent in 76. That's 89, and that's 2000. Now, those are individual shots, but actually they are representative of the changes that have happened, which are consistent with a very dramatic reduction in glacier mass and a very strong reduction in snow cover. A similar one in more detail further east, 89 and 2000. In other words, seasonal snowfall has dramatically reduced over that period of time. And again, the attempt here has not been to tell fibs, to say things that aren't true, but rather to give you a concept of the statistical changes that are well determined. Now, these changes have several impacts which are extremely important for local populations. In the middle of this, image at the top, you'll see a large lake shown in blue. That lake is dammed in by a moraine, but like most alpine moraines, most of the mass of the moraine is made of ice and not of rock. The rock simply is a thin skin on the surface. And those moraine dams, of course, will decay. And this is another example. You can see a moraine, a big moraine from the glacier coming in from the right of the image, which has dammed this lake, and most of that moraine is ice. That ice will decay. This is a little closer to home. This is one of the glaciers underneath Monte Rosa. And if you look at the top right-hand image, you'll see a blue area, which is a lake which has formed on the glacier surface. And the lower image shows that lake as well. This is another big lake dammed in by a moraine near Everest. This is the same lake dammed in by near Everest. You can see the lake there, and it's dammed in by extensive areas of moraine, and almost all of that is ice. That lake has now gone, and we know where it went. It went down the hole which you see on the right. You're looking out of a tunnel in the ice into the depression where the lake was, and the discharge of water was about 3 cubic kilometers in 15 hours. And it all passed through those tunnels. In other words, you don't need to have the whole moraine dam melt. What can happen is that water pressures in the lake can increase to such a value that they drive hydraulic connections through the buried ice, and one gets catastrophic discharges of water of this sort. And this is the sort of effect they have. This is a village in Sikkim, and in the scarred hillside, you can see the track of a major glacier dammed lake discharge. One of the other hazards which arises because of the phase of very rapid deglaciation we're now in, and it is extremely rapid, it's more rapid than any we've known for at least 10,000 years, is that hillsides like this are left behind as the glacier retreats. Those zones are very dangerous. First of all, the rock mass expands elastically as the glacier load is withdrawn. It therefore becomes weaker. Secondly, the sediments that are left down by the glacier are inherently unstable. And indeed, of course, they're not vegetated, and vegetation holds them together. Thirdly, of course, there's been much melting of mountain permafrost, which is particularly acute in the alpine zone of Europe at the present day. And thirdly, of course, many high mountain zones are areas of high seismicity, such that there are shear forces that occur from time to time, which are able to disrupt these weak rock masses and weak sediments. And the consequences of that have been quite dramatic and appear to have been increased in frequency over recent years. This is from North Ossetia. It shows a glacier area which had a major rock avalanche. And the yellow line shows the trajectory of the rock avalanche material. It went 60 kilometers down valley. This shows the glacier from which the material came. On the bottom left-hand side of the left-hand photograph, what happened was that rock masses avalanched onto the glacier surface. We think they avalanche because of two things. First of all, inherent instability because of deglaciation, and secondly, because of some permafrost melting that was happening at a higher elevation. That rock mass then, that avalanche mass, fell onto the toe of the glacier and detached a very large, forced away, a very large wedge of the terminus of the glacier. It overrode the glacier on the right-hand side, the Marley Glacier, and then shot off down the valley. You can see the avalanche track there. This is a little bit further downstream. It left a mass of 30 million cubic meters in this broad valley, and buried most of the village as it did so, with great mortality. And as it built up in that area, mud was squeezed out of the avalanche mass, which went a further 15 kilometers down valley. And had there been any villages there, they would have been destroyed. At the same time, earthquake susceptibility is a major problem in these newly deglaciated areas. This is a major slide that happened 2 years ago in the Karakoram. You can see it marked in green. And that's an example after the recent Pakistan earthquake of the frequency of mud and earth slides. 10,000 schools were destroyed. 10,000 schools were destroyed in the upland area of Pakistan during these events. It's extraordinary. Now, we can model the responses, or we're beginning to be able to model the responses of some of these glaciers to climate change. The central diagram there shows a computation of the rate of surface lowering under current conditions, and on the right-hand side, the velocity distribution in the glacier. We can then take scenario-based models of future climate from the region produced by the HADGEM model from the UK Met Office to compute over a large part of the range what the consequences of future melting might be. It's important to note that the Himalayan chains, of course, are the sources of the three great rivers of the northern Indian plain, the Indus, the Ganges, and the Brahmaputra, in addition to many of the major rivers that water western China. The glaciers and snowmelt in the Ganges basin, for example, provide about 20% of the annual flow, but what is crucial is they provide between 80 and 85% of the dry season flow of the Ganges. The foothills of the Himalayas are very arid, and they're the means those rivers, the glacier melt is the means whereby those foothills are watered and are the source of what little agricultural productivity there is. But if we utilize scenarios for the last 50 years, on the top diagram, you see the increase in the equilibrium line altitude of glaciers that's predicted for the western Himalayas, and the red line shows you the change in glacier volume during as a consequence of that increase in equilibrium line altitude. In the lower diagram, which shows discharge in kilometers cubed per year, the red line shows the change in discharge as a consequence of the destruction of the glaciers, the fact that glacier mass is effectively passing down the rivers. The purple dashed line shows the impact on seasonal discharge. And what it suggests is that there will be a reduction in the glacier contribution to the headwaters of the great rivers of the Indian Plain by something like 60 to 70% over the next 50 years. Which in terms of agriculture, of course, is utterly devastating. Now, I better stop here, I think, but just say one thing. There are a number of us who've been working internationally in trying to support government, those few governments that have been arguing that what is required, particularly under present circumstances, is some form of global hazard monitoring, forecasting, warning. Those of us who are working in the glacial domain know what a glacier, or what the scientific component of a glacier contribution to that might be. But what is crucial, of course, is that we need the science and technology which will give us monitoring of the Earth, which will permit us to integrate the data, which will permit us to integrate our models so that they're able to produce outputs. The outputs ought to be medium to long-term forecasts to government. They ought to be hazard warnings to government and UN agencies. The responses that are required, again, twofold. One is long-term, which is about education, it's about environmental policy and planning, and it's economic and social policy and planning. And the other one is short-term emergency, which is inevitably international, which is about communication, preparation, and cooperation. There are moves afoot to attempt to utilize the existing international networks, which are the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, the WHO, World Health Organization, which also has a very comprehensive network, and interestingly, the Global Seismological Network, which was set up to monitor the Test Ban Treaty observance. And my view, and that of many, I think, is that we seriously need now to put our scientific understanding of the way in which the Earth system is working into real political efforts to ensure that, you know, we can manage the way in which we adapt to the changes that are now happening. Thanks.
C'était Geoffroy Bolton de l'école de géosciences à l'université d'Édimbourg en Grande-Bretagne. Il développait l'historique des événements glaciaires extrêmes. Il était précédé par Hervé Le Treut et Jean-Claude André, tous deux membres de l'Académie des sciences. Leur communication portait sur les cyclones tropicaux ainsi que sur les observations de changements atmosphériques et hydrologiques. C'est la fin de cette quatrième retransmission du colloque intitulé « Écosystèmes et événements climatiques extrêmes » organisé par l'Académie des sciences en juillet 2007. Nous vous invitons à poursuivre l'écoute des communications des autres scientifiques dans la médiathèque de Canal Académie pour tout savoir sur les événements extrêmes passés, les leçons à tirer et ses conséquences écologiques à court et long terme. Merci de nous avoir suivis et à très vite sur Canal Académie.